supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. A scientist who goes through 1,000 failed experiments until he gets one step closer to uncovering something. A violinist who spends hours practicing the same notes. A kid who keeps going to school, studying, and getting good grades, all this despite terrible problems at home. What do they have in common? It's grit, the ability to stick things out, to focus, to stay on path toward a goal. Grit and self-control are hot concepts in psychology and education right now, giving us new ideas about what it takes to help kids succeed. On today's show, we'll talk about grit, what it is, who has it, and if we can learn and teach it. Our guests are Angela Duckworth and Amanda Jefferson. Duckworth is a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. She is with their Positive Psychology Center. Angela, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Amanda Jefferson is the executive director of Summer Search. It's a Philadelphia program for low-income kids that helps build up grit and resilience through mentoring and adventurous trips. We're going to hear about them. Amanda, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
So, Angela, let's start with you. I've got to say, I've only heard of the concept of grit other than in the movies. I'm just very recently, are you the first to study it?
I don't think I'm the first to study it, and I'm certainly not the first to think that perseverance in life is important. But I guess I will take claim for publishing research articles in psychology naming grit as this particular capacity to sustain perseverance and passion over the very long term.
The grit. Now, you're from an Ivy League school. I mean, you're a top-notch researcher. You couldn't come up with something that was two or three syllables?
I actually prefer our one syllable. Now, there are some one-syllable words that aren't particularly positive in their connotation, but I have to say that in my second year of graduate school, and I had just started working on this concept, and my advisor, Marty Seligman, who many of your listeners, I'm sure, know as the grandfather of positive psychology, at one point literally stopped meeting with me until I came up with a really good, memorable name for this construct. And I came into his office after thinking about this, and I had this list of synonyms, you know, pluck, stamina, courage, tenacity, perseverance. And I think that the name grit actually connotes everything that we want it to. It's sort of a blend of, you know, being passionate about something, but also sticking through with the effort in addition to that interest. So anyway, it seems to be quite useful.
So I watched your TED Talk, which, by the way, was fabulous.
Thanks.
And you said that for the first 10 years post-college, you didn't have grit because you wandered around from career to career. And I remember what you said, that you wound up 10 years later being an interesting person or having an interesting resume. So is grit about tenacity?
I would say that grit is not only about working hard. I often give talks, and undergraduates will come up to me afterwards and say, you know, here's what I did to show how gritty I was. You know, aren't I gritty for, you know, working 80 hours a week for the last 3 weeks to accomplish this amazing goal, whatever it is. And I think that's not grit. So during those 10 years, between the age of 22 and 32, when I was working 80-hour weeks, right, in the various things that I was doing, I had the effort part. But I think what I lacked was that consistent direction, getting better and better at one thing over time. And at the end of a decade, I had done many things, you know, with admirable initial effort, but you end up being an amateur, an expert amateur, if you will, at 10 things versus one expert at one thing.
So what about the person that does that and doesn't feel there's anything missing from their lives, that are just enjoying the smorgasbord?
I think that's a great question. Is it necessarily a bad thing to not have a lot of grit?
Yeah, there's an implied judgment.
Absolutely. I would say that there's nothing wrong necessarily with lacking grit if you're okay with the consequences. For me, the consequence of not being a super high achiever and whatever it is that I had chosen to do was not acceptable. However, if you value other things in life like novelty, diversity of interests, breadth over depth, then I think it's absolutely fine to not beat yourself about not being gritty enough.
Self-control is a part of grit. So what does that look like for people with and without it?
I would say grit, on the one hand, is perseverance and passion over the very long term. In children that are very young, that still means perseverance and passion for single goals over months. When you're talking about school-age children, late adolescents, like kids who are in high school, mm-hmm. that's where grit looks like pursuing things for several years in a row. And when you get into adulthood, it means pursuing a career, an important avocation for decades. The time scale of grit, therefore, is extremely long. Self-control really is about being able to resist momentary, hourly temptations, was the phrase actually that Francis Galton used. So self-control is being able to control your attention, your emotion, and your behavior in the face of these momentary distractions over very short timescales. And I think actually there are in the world people who are extremely gritty and yet quite poor in self-control. They're rare, but they do exist, suggesting that you can actually be one and not the other.
In my clinical office, I see the dark side of self-control, which is self-deprivation of food, of sleep, of even joy. People deprive themselves of joy. That's not the self-control you're talking about.
No, it's been a question that's occupied me as well for the last 9 or 10 years studying self-control. Is the very high end of self-control anorexia? Is it OCD?
Right.
And I think it's not. I think actually, and you would tell me because you're the clinician and not me, but I think individuals who suffer from those psychopathologies actually don't feel like they are regulating their attention, their emotion, and their behavior in accordance with their own personally held goals. I think oftentimes what looks to the outsiders as over control, actually, for the person who's undergoing it, is in fact a kind of lack of control. So my feeling is that very few individuals in American society suffer from too much self-control. And for that matter, I think there are very few people who we would say in American society are too gritty.
Yeah, you're not kidding. I was thinking when you were talking about the ability to sustain things, goals, over years. I was thinking of people I know who stay in jobs that they don't like, stay in marriages that they don't like. And, I'm thinking, is that grit? And then I realized one word you've used a couple of times today. That's passion.
Exactly. I think that's the distinction between grit for something you love and, the kind of compliance or the inertia that would characterize other careers that have that continuity but don't have that passion. And I would argue that when you find somebody who is in the classroom, say, year after year as a burnt out teacher, that's not so much a demonstration of grit as it is of this kind of, momentum that carries people. And the way that you know is that if you're really gritty about what you do, then you work continuously to get better at it. You get deeper and deeper into it. And I would argue that those folks that you've described are not waking up every day and thinking, how can I do this better?
Let me ask you about passion. And I don't know if which one of you I should ask. Kids all have passion. When I see adults in my office, I don't know about the general population, so few people I see have passion about much of anything. So can passion be taught or cultivated? I guess let me turn to you, Amanda. I mean, you're the teacher here.
Sure. I see what you're saying. I see our kids every day, and they are so inspirational. I mean, these 16-year-olds, they just have so much fire in their belly and so much desire to do what they want to do. I think that passion can be in adults. I first got into this business when I was working with an international exchange organization in D.C. right after graduating from college, and we were sending mostly affluent kids abroad to do study abroad programs, and then I got placed on a project to go into D.C. public high schools and find kids to go abroad to Japan. Kikkoman was funding a scholarship. And none of these kids in the public schools were applying for this program. So I, thought to myself, I'm this little 23-year-old whippersnapper. What is wrong with these kids? And you go across the Anacostia River and you go through the metal detectors and you go into the schools and you sit in the classroom and then you say, oh. You look at the faces of these kids and you realize they're just in survivor mode and nobody's thinking about going to Japan. One by one, though, we did. We got them to go and we sent them to Japan on 5 and 10,000 scholarships, and they came back absolutely changed kids. So I think in my situation, that was the one thing that instilled this passion in me, that from there, living in D.C., I got into international consulting, all these sexy international jobs, but I was forever haunted by those kids. And when you come and live in a city like Philadelphia, it's not like D.C. where the poverty sort of hides from you. Here in Philadelphia, the poverty does not hide. And so I'm working at an Ivy League institution. I was working at Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania, and you take the subway every day, and what you see, you can't forget. And so I think for me, the passion was ignited 10 years ago, and I just haven't been able to put it out. So I think for adults, you can ignite passion. And when I talk to the supporters that are supporting our work every day, I see them getting more and more passionate every day.
I think the word is right. It's a question of igniting it rather than instilling it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever met a baby, a toddler, who didn't have passion. But it kind of goes away.
I agree with that. I think the word ignite is perfect, right? Because it's not so much taught the way that you could teach a kid algebra as brought out, cultivated, encouraged. I would say this about young people. I mean, kids have so much energy and enthusiasm for sure. And the question of, how that gets lost in the transition to adulthood is a good one. But I think there is one thing that as adults, as the sort of shepherds in this process, we should be mindful of, which is that I don't know that kids will spontaneously and completely on their own cultivate one or two of their passions to maturity. Left to their own devices, kids are drawn by novelty. They're drawn by the steep part of the learning curve. Necessarily, when you get deeper into something, your marginal return on that next day of involvement is maybe still positive, but it's diminishing. You're not learning as much as you did when you were just starting out. And I think to some extent, there's a role for adults to play to encourage kids to discover the joys of mastery, which frankly are different from the joys of trying something completely new.
I like that you were called parents shepherds. I think most of us are really sheep in shepherd's clothing, but don't tell the kids that. So, Amanda, let's hear about Summer Search. What is it?
We are a program that works with low-income kids, and we are basically trying to break a cycle of poverty. We are trying to instill in these kids at a really crucial point in adolescence character skills like the work that Angela's doing, grit, problem-solving, curiosity, and it's a 5-year program. So it's a very intense, long hours working, because these aren't easy skills to teach, but they are teachable. We're a national organization that was founded in San Francisco 21 years ago, and we have 7 sites around the country. So we feel extremely excited about the research that's come out now, because we feel like we know that this has been working for so long. And finally, we can sort of shout from the mountaintops with people like Paul Tuff and Angela Duckworth that this is working, and we're excited to work with them to understand why it's working.
You said it's teachable.
It's teachable. It absolutely is.
How?
We work in several different ways. One, where the name Summer Search comes from, is actually we send kids out on these outlandish, out of their comfort zone experiences in the summer, where they are hiking, canoeing, trekking, meeting affluent peers, getting on a plane for the first time. And during those times, it's just team building, leadership, resilience, grit sort of on steroids for that 2 to 4 weeks. The second trip is usually a trip abroad where they're gaining perspective. They're going to Ghana and Rwanda and for the first time actually understanding maybe life for me isn't maybe as hard as I thought that it was, that it's different for others. And where our tagline is where change begins. So I believe that those summer programs are a big piece of where the change begins and teaching them those skills. And then the second piece that's really important is the mentorship. So they have a well-placed adult in their life that's working with them on a weekly basis. They're checking in. And it's all about this insight-oriented mentoring is what we call it. And it's holding the mirror up. All of this chaos is happening to you in your life, in your school, in your home, in your community. What are you doing? How can you control that? And it's these momentary impulses. You know, we have kids who are getting suspended time after time after a time because they have problems with female authority. So they keep speaking up to the student, to the teacher. What if you just breathe for 5 seconds? How will that change your fate? And all of a sudden, teaching a kid a skill like that, their grades start going up, their attendance is going up, and all of a sudden, their college opportunities have opened up a whole new world for them.
Mini mindfulness.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It's a meditative experience.
Absolutely. So, you know, when kids go on our summer experiences, Angela talks a lot about goals. What are your goals for the summer experience? My goals are not to look at things in black and white. My goals are to be open to others. My goals are, and those are goals that we work with them on a really intense 3-year period before they go to college, and it can be life-changing.
We've got to take a short break. When we come back, hopefully we'll hear from some of those kids that our executive producer Mike and Scott spoke with. We're talking about the concept of grit today on Voices in the Family. It's a combination of tenacity, kind of belief in yourself, belief you can do it, passion. And for younger people, it's often the availability of mentors and guidance or shepherds, as Angela suggested. My guests are Angela Duckworth and Amanda Jefferson. Duckworth, a professor of psychology at University of Pennsylvania. Jefferson is the executive director of Summer Search that we just heard about and hopefully we'll hear more about. Well, we'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
In Studio 360, we don't worry about first impressions.
I like art that at first I hate, that makes me think, oh my God, that's the kind that always wins me over, and that's the kind of art that changes things.
Like the movie director John Waters, we try to look beneath the surface. Every week we bring you stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and new ideas. I'm Kurt Anderson. Get inside the creative mind. Tomorrow morning at 7 on WHYY.
When you want more than just the headlines about issues affecting the Delaware Valley and the Jersey Shore, listen to Morning Edition. And when you prefer in-depth national and international reporting, well, we have that too on WHYY from NPR News. I'm Joanne Allen. Join us for news, feature reporting, traffic and weather, all on Morning Edition. Heard weekdays from 6 to 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about grit, which correlates very highly with overall success. We're talking about grit with Angela Duckworth and Amanda Jefferson. Our executive producer, Mike and Scott, visited your program, Amanda, and Summer Search, and spoke with several of your students, Kamira, Tiara, Joseph, Felix, and Umo. Here's an excerpt from that conversation. Mike asked them how being part of Summer Search has changed them. Let's listen.
The mentoring was really helpful because people didn't normally ask me about my everyday life or wanted to know, like, about me in general. So it felt good to, like, let somebody know about me. And it helped me realize who I really am and all my strengths and all the confidence that I was lacking. Like, when I went on my first trip, I did not think that I would be able to live in the woods for 2 weeks. I didn't think I could do it, but I did it. And I didn't cry all the time, So I give myself credit for that. And I found a whole bunch of confidence.
How about you?
The most important thing for me is definitely the encouragement that they gave me. Just knowing to, like, never quit. If something bad happens, like, life moves on. And then gaining the resiliency to know that, like, you have the ability to move on from this and to learn from this.
Can you give me an example of something that happened or would happen that might have discouraged you and how you addressed that?
Yeah, I have many examples. the one that is most popular, I guess, is me not being able to go to the school that I wanted to go to. So as you can imagine, like, my dreams were crushed. So I had to go to community school, and they helped me adjust and see that, like, it wasn't, like, a horrible thing that I wasn't able to go to the school, and that with better preparation, I can go to the school that I really want to, which is what I'm working on now.
Well, I know before the program, I wasn't the best person to be around. Definitely my social skills were terrible. Like, I was very angry. And I used to keep a lot of things bottled up. But because of the program, it helped me, like, better myself. Because when I come here, I feel like I'm not being judged. I was always so used to everywhere I go, somebody would judge me without even knowing me or getting to know who I was, which built up with the anger and all that. But they helped me, like, figure it out little by little, find ways to solve problems for myself. And, like, today I find myself a way better person. And then the trips, they just helped me figure out things I thought I could never do whatsoever. I pushed past the limits that I thought I had on my own.
So what were you angry about, and how did you express that anger before you came here?
I was one of those people that you can say I was angry at the world. That I'll get angry for, like, little things or just anybody. If I didn't like you, you said something different from me. I'm more sociable now, and people like to be around me.
And what have people noticed about you? Your family, your teachers, what have they said since you've gotten involved with this?
That I'm a brighter person from the past. And, like, just as I can, they can see my future actually happening, because I lost all hope in it without this program. I was just like, I'm not going to make it there. And they seen me losing hope in everything. I was just going to give up on school. But, like, I feel like I can make it now in the future. And I know I have a future for a fact.
Why did you think you had no future? What built that up in you that you thought, I'm not going to make it?
If you look into my family, a lot of them are dropouts. Not many people resort to, like, high things. So a lot of people would judge me and say, I'm going to end up like them. And then I was like, well, after a while, all of it started getting to me. And I was like, you know, I'm going to end up like my family. So why should I try harder to be different from them?
Well, before Summer Search, a lot of people, when they see me, I come off as a bully sometimes, or irresponsible, or ignorant, or rude. Because some things I say, but I don't mean, but it's only to protect myself or I won't get hurt. So when they hear, like, me talk or some certain things that I do, they're like, oh, he's trouble. In reality, I was just a kid who just wanted someone to speak to. I was just a kid who just wanted a father. And it was really hard trying to find that bond. But with Summer Church, I did. I realized that you can't have a family, and they don't have to be blood. You can have someone to actually hear your problems and see what you're going through. That you don't need to take care of everything by yourself. That it's okay to have a friend. That changed me for who I am, and that also opened my eyes for a better goal that I want to reach.
And were there things going on in the community around you that had a negative impact on you?
Well, I wouldn't say it was every day, but when you grow up in Philadelphia, as part of North Philly, you get used to hearing bullet shots. Mm-hmm. When you hear bullet shots, it's like hearing the TV. You get used to it. You're able to go to sleep to it. So, therefore, it really didn't affect me. I was used to seeing drug dealers on the corner or females pregnant. Stuff like that, it didn't faze me anymore because it was like an everyday schedule. It was the same homeless people, the same drug dealers. It was the same girls talking about who their baby father was. It was just the same. It was nothing different.
And how did that affect your aspirations for your own life? Just the environment around you. And anybody wants to weigh in on that?
Yeah, so like Joseph was saying, once you see all that around you, you think that that's the normal. And that's how you're supposed to be, you know? And that's all that you're able to accomplish. Maybe graduate high school, have a child at a young age, my grandparents were on drugs, so that's what I seen, so that's what I was used to every day. So I thought that was the normal, you know what I mean? And and my mom wasn't around, and I thought that was normal. So the idea of, like, fatalism, being around and thinking that that's all that you're able to do with no one around to encourage you, no one around to tell you that, oh, there's a way out. You know, oh, you can go to college. You can, there is an ear. Someone will listen to you. You know what I mean?
That was our executive producer, Mike and Scott, talking with several of the students at Summer Search. Well, ladies, I got to tell you, I picked several themes out. One was this last one by Umo, who talked about, I think it was he who talked about, your family doesn't have to be blood. And when he talked about all of the problems he had in his life, he didn't talk about anybody fixing them or even helping him with his problems. He talked about listening and caring. I mean, it's, you don't have to change anything. So can this be available for kids outside of programs like Summer Search?
I hope so. I think that I similarly picked up on this theme of the kids being very grateful to adults who had changed their lives, and in this case, adults who were, you know, part of the Summer Search program, not people in their blood family. But I think the subtle but important difference is it's not thanking the adults for fixing everything, for smoothing the path and making life, you know, rainbows and unicorns, but actually to help them help themselves. And what I hear are these very realistic appraisals about how hard it will continue to be as they, you know, move closer and closer to goals they wouldn't even have let themselves have before. Hmm. But I do think that's the role of adults, is to be supportive, but in always keeping in mind that the goal is to make the children autonomous and able to care for themselves.
That's Angela Duckworth. She's at the University of Pennsylvania with the Positive Psychology Program, and she studies grit. We're also here with Amanda Jefferson, who runs that program, Summer Search, where we just heard from the kids. I want to talk about one of the things I heard that really, really struck me, and that's a kind of empowerment, a kind of, you know, they believe they have some control over their lives. I wonder how that is taught.
Yeah, it's a really long process with a lot of peaks and valleys. Our kids come to us really raw. We're actually recruiting our new class of sophomores right now. And they come to the office and they're scared. They're nervous. They don't know what to talk about. They don't know what to say. They don't know what they're in for. But slowly but surely, over that period of 2.5 years, you just start peeling back the layers. And to your earlier point, I feel like our mentoring model is quite nuanced, but it really is just sort of listening and asking the right questions and helping people guide themselves to the right answers. We see our kids fail a lot, and we want them to fail. We sort of call it failing forward. Paul Tough wrote the article in the New York Times, you know, what if the secret to success is failure? Because so often with our low-income kids that we work with, it's one thing that they could fail at that could be the difference between them and success. And it's teaching them through listening and through asking the right questions and through guiding them through their own insights about how to deal with that failure.
Give me an example.
One of our students, who was interviewed by Mike and as well, she has dealt with anger her whole life. She has a lot to be angry about. But we worked with her on how to deal with that a little bit better. But even now, after we've worked with her for 2.5 years, she was working on filling out a really prestigious college application process. And something had happened where there was a little bit of a snafu with the program, and Northwestern University just didn't get the right paperwork. And she went back to sort of her old ways, threw a huge fit, ran out of the office, and was minutes away from missing the 5 o'clock deadline. That anger, that moment, was the difference between her getting into Northwestern University on a full scholarship or not. So we as mentors and we as staff are working with them so that in those moments – the dire consequences. They have the tools that they need to avoid the dire consequences. And we see it all the time with kids who are on the verge of dropping out of college.
Wait a minute. You got to finish that story. I'm holding my breath. So what happened before 5 o'clock?
She learned to calm down. She called. The error was fixed and the application was submitted.
Vey. Woo. Yeah, but I get it about failing forward. I wondered about other kids, and I'll turn to you, Angel. You know, we're talking about kids who are living with great adversity. What about kids who are upper middle class, who don't have so much adversity? Are they less likely to have grit?
It's a fascinating question, whether kids who have a smoother path don't, you know, is it possible that they don't learn as well how to get up again because they don't have a lot of practice falling? We don't have data to answer that question specifically. I can certainly share my intuitions, being a, you know, mainline mom of two girls, where I feel, you know, we as parents quite understandably have the tendency to bubble wrap our children because we want to protect them from every possible scrape and scratch. My sense is, and I think there's some suggestive data, for example, children who have higher IQs on average have lower grit scores. And that's another kind of smoothing the path, right? Things are easier for you because you learn things faster. And if that's the case, that when things are easier for you, you don't learn to get up again, that would certainly speak to that. I do think we need to let our privileged, loved children fail on their own. When kids come home and they say, I forgot my history book, how many parents who are listening to this will run and email the teacher, get a PDF, and so, you know, crisis averted? As opposed to what my parents told me when I actually forgot my history book in elementary school, which is, tomorrow, don't forget your history book. And that was it. And I went in and bore the consequences of my inaction, I guess I should say. So I do think that we need kids to be challenged and supported. That seems to me, from what I'm hearing about some research, to be this magic combination that the kids are being stretched beyond their comfort zone. So they are being challenged. Maybe where that comfort zone is different for a kid of a middle class or an upper middle class background. But in any case, the secret ingredient seems to be that challenge plus the support and the love. And with that, you know, that's kind of tough love, right? It's, you know, both I'm going to push you a little bit and expect you to do more things on your own than you would be inclined to do if I weren't pushing you. But also, there's this underlying incredible message of love and support.
As I listen to you, the kind of parenting you're describing is a difference between parenting from fear or parenting from faith. And the kind of parenting you're talking about is parenting from faith, faith that your child can fail and still be okay, bruise their knee, you know, see something bleeding and faith that they'll be okay, that they'll
cry a little bit, they won't dissolve. Absolutely. Yeah. Faith is probably the perfect word because it does require a leap across, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not an easy thing, I think, for a parent to do. But I would argue that it's a necessary thing for parents to do.
Mm. Yeah, I would too. Amanda, one of the concepts here is accountability. And that's kind of a political hot potato here. We saw it in the presidential elections where accountability often means you're responsible for how you got here. You pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and we call that empowering. So what do you mean by accountability, and how do you foster it?
Our model is based on something called RAP, which stands for reflection, altruism, and performance. And a big chunk of the non-cognitive skills that we're trying to develop in them does exist in that performance bucket. And one of the most important ones for our program is follow through. Even just to get into the program, kids have to have a certain amount of follow through. And they can be C and D students, but there's that passion that's been ignited at some point within them that makes them fill out the paperwork and write the essay and get the tax forms from their parents to show that they're low income and to show up at that interview. I mean, those four steps are enough. We start with about 250 kids and end up with about 30. So just those four steps alone can sort of eliminate a lot of kids in terms that just don't have the follow through that we need. And then our program is also, you know, deliberately sequenced so that when they're failing early on in the program, the consequences aren't as dire as in Umo's case when she gets to Northwestern University. So for their first trip, they're filling out health forms and applications and getting, you know, maybe their passport and all of that sort of thing. So follow through in our program is really, really important. And it's deliberately sequenced in that way so that by the time that they get to college, they know to show up at the financial aid office and ask about that typo. I mean, we've got kids who, because of a typo on a financial aid form, just show up at the office and say, well, this is, I don't have financial aid, so I'm not going to college. You know, and we're teaching our kids go to the financial aid office and talk to them. So follow through is huge. And it's something that must exist in the student, at least a glimpse of it when we start working with them. Otherwise, they won't be successful with us.
We've got to take a short break. And when we come back, I want to hear more about grit. Who has it? Who doesn't have it? Can it be taught? How can it be taught? And I also want to know about gender. Who's more likely to have it by gender? Obviously, we're talking about grit today on Voices in the Family with psychologist Angela Duckworth, who studies grit at their Positive Psychology Center, and Amanda Jefferson, who directs a Philadelphia program called Summer Search, which actually teaches kids grit and resilience. Like I said, we'll be back in just 1 minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY. FM.
If you celebrate the holidays by decorating the Christmas tree, lighting the menorah, or drinking from the Unity Cup, don't forget to celebrate WHYY. During the season of goodwill, please show yours by becoming a station member. Make a pledge of support by December 31st by calling 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org. Your generosity today secures WHYY's future. Thanks.
Starting your own plants from seed is not for the timid. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to produce plausible plants, if you can accept that sunny windowsills are horticultural horror shows. That's You Bet Your Garden, this morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about grit today with Angela Duckworth and Amanda Jefferson. Angela, one of the concepts that came out earlier in the show is altruism. We didn't talk much about that. So how does that fit into grit, and can you teach altruism?
I think altruism, doing for others as opposed to yourself, is not the same as grit, but it's certainly possible to be both gritty and altruistic. And when you are both gritty and altruistic, you would have what Bill Damon at Stanford University calls purpose. So I think that it's a very powerful idea, the idea that you could be gritty about something that, of course, would benefit the world. I mean, you could be gritty about your own little stamp collection, which would be great for you, but wouldn't necessarily help anybody else.
Can altruism be taught? Amanda?
I think it can. I think the students that we find have a glimmer of altruism when where we usually see it is on empathy. And empathy is really important because we're asking students to turn the mirror on themselves and to be curious and reflective about their own behaviors. And so even if students aren't ready to do that quite yet at the very beginning, what you can see them doing is exhibiting empathy for others. They might talk about, you know, it's okay that my mom, I never see my mom because she has to work three jobs because my dad is in jail. It's so, you know, so you see them exhibiting these empathetic behaviors, and that actually helps them to start turn the mirror on themselves and to understand themselves. So that helps us to get at the piece of reflection. And then I think the second thing that's really important about altruism for our program is that we're trying to we're not just trying to change the lives of 124 kids in Philadelphia and thousands across the country. We're trying to create these seeds of change in their community. So when I talk to my kids, yes, I know that our program is all about creating, you know, college graduates, but I say to especially our Black boys, I want you to be a good father. I want you to be a good husband. And some of them look at me as if I'm saying something crazier to them than I want you to go to college, because I can probably count on one hand the number of Black boys that I know that have a father at home. So I think it can be taught. And it is something that for me, I think if I can create a generation of kids who then go on to be good moms and good dads and good wives and good husbands, that's almost as important to me, if not more important than the college graduation piece.
Well, you know, I'm going to wander into Angela's neighborhood of research here, and you know, compassion and love of others is another one of those things that's in there. It needs to be reignited. There's lots of research about toddlers and exhibiting compassion, and God knows they show love. I mean, they sure
show kindness, they show generosity, they show gratitude spontaneously, which is wonderful. And again, yeah, I think the idea of cultivating that, modeling it, creating opportunities to have them practice that, because I think these things are there and they're spontaneous, but they are also, you know, skills and habits. And so we can either abolish them through systematically mistreating kids, or we can encourage them.
And one of the ways we abolish that is through this insane push for self-esteem at all costs. And that's an altruism killer, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Professor.
I think there are some reports, and it's not that opinion is completely undivided, but there are some suggestions that we are, as a country, becoming more and more narcissistic and self-centered year after year. And I think that is, you know, very much to do with this movement of, you know, self-esteem at all costs. I took my 9-year-old to a track meet last year, and she literally got an 8th place ribbon for a race that only had 8 children. And I thought it was like a New Yorker cartoon. I was like, really? This is kind of funny. And she even found it funny. She's like, yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. So, you know, why is it so important that, you know, that we don't keep score in games anymore? So, you know, God forbid somebody lose or somebody not win. I think the message should be, how is the game played? You know, did you carry yourself with character? You know, did you win today or did you lose today? What are you going to do tomorrow? Anyway, I think you're right. Self-esteem at all costs is an absolutely terrible way to raise our children.
I'm also of the belief that esteem should never, ever be for the self. It should always be for others, which gets us back to the altruism and the role model issue. Angela, I threatened to ask you about grit by gender.
Yeah, I was actually smiling to myself when you mentioned that question before the break. In our data, and we now have thousands and thousands of people who have taken the grit scale.
Am I going to be okay here?
Are you worrying that the men are going to be
worried.
Less gritty?
I'm
You're
little,
worried for your own
I'm
half of the species?
Yeah. No, well, just for me.
Or just for you in particular. I'm sure you're very gritty. We don't find a striking difference between men and women or girls and boys in grit. So on average, you know, the scores for grit are quite similar. Whether people are answering grit questions about themselves or when parents or teachers are rating their kids or managers rating the people who work for them. So we don't find a big difference. I will say there is a very slight small difference favoring women and girls. But it's not huge. And what that means is there are plenty of boys and men who are, you know, just as or grittier than, you know, girls. It's just right. That there's an average difference.
What about across the life cycle?
Across the life cycle, we see a much more striking and definitive pattern favoring older individuals. It's almost a linear trend where, you know, every decade it seems that there's a reliable increase in grit. And I think there are two possibilities there. Either we grow grittier with age, which resonates with me in my own life story, you know, kind of figuring out that grit was what I needed to get where I wanted to go and sort of acquiring grit as I moved on in life. But it's also possible that as a country, the older people grew up in a different culture in which perhaps grit was more encouraged, so that if you grew up in the 40s or the 50s, you know, this kind of tenacity and getting really good at one thing as opposed to dabbling in a lot of things, perhaps that was more valued.
I also have a thought, you know, you talk about across the life cycle. I told a story in one of my books about a window repair guy who was at my house, had a thick Italian accent, bright, bright guy. And I chatted with him. Turned out he was Jewish, which was terribly a curious thing for me. And he said he wanted, when he was a child, he wanted to be a rabbi in Rome. And here he is changing windows in South Jersey. And he looked upward as though reflecting. And he said, you know, he said, I think we're born square and we die round. And I think that addresses grit, you know, that we don't have so many rough edges that get knocked off anymore, that throw us off kilter. We're more round and can get through the waters of life better.
I think this idea, this strong intuition that many of us have, that we do truly mature as we get through life, and we were better at it in all the various ways that one has to be a human being. I mean, there's some evidence for that. And people are more self-controlled as they grow in age. We're much better at regulating our emotions and our attention. And actually, people are nicer as they move from their 20s, 30s, 40s, and on. So maybe grit is part of that maturational trend. Maybe it's one of the things that we develop, that we practice, that we grow.
Maybe what happens to us is we are able to regulate ourselves and our emotions in inverse correlation with how well we regulate our bodies.
Maybe there's an upside for the downside, maybe.
There's something about that. Amanda, tell me about your vision for your school in the long run.
Gosh, change the world. We talk about alleviating poverty, and I mean, that's exactly what I'm here to do. I mean, we did a study. We just launched a strategic planning exercise and did a study that there's 3,000 kids in this city that I think could greatly benefit from our program. And so, you know, we're dealing with kids who are living in multi-generational poverty. And my goal is that in 30 years, we won't be talking about them living in that we've stopped it at this generation. So, you know, there's a lot of change happening in the school district right now. And we see that change, you know, our neighborhood schools are turning into charter schools, our schools are closing, and we see our kids involved in that turmoil. And so Dr. Height has a long road ahead of him in terms of fixing that. But there was a couple little paragraphs in his action plan that talked about building academic tenacity and talked about non-cognitive skills here in Philadelphia. And I think that Summer Search has a role in working with people like Angela and other organizations in the city to say, how can I work beyond the 125 kids that I already work with? How can we figure out how to teach this?
Which raises a question about these concepts of grit. Are they working their way into mainstream education?
I don't know about mainstream education. I certainly have an email box and a voicemail box full of messages from educators from really diverse backgrounds, you know, Catholic schools, private schools, charter schools, public schools, fourth grade teachers, school superintendents, assistant superintendents for curriculum and instruction. And again, I, you know, for sure did not invent this concept. I mean, nobody patents human nature. But I think what we're seeing is a renewed interest, a sort of a respect for all those aspects of child competence that are not well measured by standardized achievement tests, which were really the only metric that was valued by policies like No Child Left Behind.
Yeah, one of your articles was entitled, What Did No Child Left Behind Leave Behind?
That's exactly right. That particular article was documenting in a series of longitudinal samples of kids that we followed over time that things like self-control really come out in a kid's report card grades. So if you have a really self-controlled child, they will have good grades and they will increase their report card grades over time. unlike standardized achievement test scores, where effort actually does not predict, you know, huge changes in their standardized test scores over time. And our contention was that if you really value things like self-control and, by the way, lots of other things that we talked about on the show, like altruism and so forth, you have to be careful what you're measuring, because what gets counted is ending up to be, in this day and age, what counts.
I do have to ask you a question that's been in the back of my mind, Angela, since you started talking about this program, and that is funding. It's expensive. Where does the money come from?
Our money comes from about 65% individual donors and about 35% foundations. So it's purely privately funded. So funding is a huge issue. I mean, I talked about serving 3,000 kids, and it's going to take a long way to get there. But we're really lucky to work with a really generous group of people and some foundations that have backed us really significantly.
And how can we learn more about this program?
Our website is www.summersearch.org. There's lots of really great stories there about the kids that we work with. We're having a big event in Philadelphia on March 14th. It's our second annual. Last year was our coming out party. This year is our second annual party called the Leadership Dinner, where you'll hear student stories and get to meet our other 300 supporters here in the city. It's a really wonderful event, and I'd love for people to come out, and that's on our website as well.
Well, we'll get that link on our website too. Angela, so tell us about what your work is about there. You're doing more than have your blinders on and researching grit.
Yeah, where I'd like my work to go in the next 10 years is intervention. It's all well and good to document what predicts these things statistically, but really what people want to know is, how do we cultivate grit intentionally in children and also adults? How do we cultivate self-control, et cetera? So we're partnering with, at the moment, charter schools like KIPP and Mastery, locally here in Philadelphia as well as elsewhere. We'd love to be able to work with organizations like SummerSearch as well, because my gut intuition, and that comes in part from my experience as a classroom teacher, is that there's plenty of learning going on outside the walls of academia. But what academics might bring to a collaboration is or techniques for systematically measuring and studying things. What would happen if we took educators and practitioners together with scientists and working on the same problems? That's the vision.
I love your visions, both of you, and I am so grateful that you both have grit. And so I'm thinking it's going to happen.
Thanks.
I want to thank you both so much for joining us today and for the work you do. My guests have been Angela Duckworth and Amanda Jefferson. Duckworth's a professor of psychology at University of Pennsylvania, and she's with their Positive Psychology Center. Jefferson directs Philadelphia program called Summer Search, which teaches kids grit and resilience. You can find more information on our website, whyy.org/voices, where you can also listen to archived editions of our show. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer for audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Jennifer Lynn produces Voices in the Family. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. And hey, special thanks to Gita Simons for her enormous help with today's show. Thanks, Gita. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.